I'm RT Custer, co-founder and CEO of Vortic Watch Company, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. The startup story would not be possible if it wasn't for the support of our sponsor, MoboCash. Move money like a miracle with MoboCash, the free money app that kicks cash. Download MoboCash app on iTunes or Google Play today, and you'll get your slick new Mobo card in the mail. You are no longer dependent upon digital currency alone, but you'll have a card that allows you to purchase at POS stations, restaurants, buy online, anywhere that you want to use your money. No credit check, no credit impact, quick direct deposit, FDIC insured, and free to register and activate. Support our sponsor, MoboCash. Visit mobo.cash or thestartupstory.co/mobocash. There is absolutely no denying that small businesses and entrepreneurs are the backbone of our economy. It's not the Fortune 500 companies that drive our economy. It's the small businesses that are striving to do big things. But I'm going to be honest, sometimes our efforts can appear to be significant only to us. It's when we participate in or pursue something larger than ourselves or our own efforts that we can truly see how much of an impact we can make. That said, our guest today has a bit of a different perspective because his startup exists in a space where he has to stand toe-to-toe with industry giants from day one. Our guest today is positioned in an industry where most of the manufacturing is done overseas, and he is fighting to keep the manufacturing of his product entirely in the United States. Our guest is RT Custer, CEO and co-founder for Vortic Watch Company. Yes, you heard me correctly. A watch company, not a digital watch to compete with the likes of Apple or Samsung, but a unique one-of-a-kind analog watch. His passion for this unique craft does not just reside in the product, but also in the process. Vortic watches are absolutely works of art and conversation pieces, and the fact that RT wants to bring watchmaking back to the U.S. is a mission that we should all want to support. In this episode, you will learn how necessary it is to have people around you that believe in what you are doing, because there are moments in the journey that will get incredibly dark. You will see how important it is to simply start the journey without needing to have all the answers from day one. And you'll hear firsthand how powerful it is when business owners support other business owners. Let's be clear. RT's mission to bring watchmaking back to the United States via Vortic Watches is an incredibly ambitious feat. That said, RT is benefiting not just from the 1800s, but also the legacy of his grandfather and great-grandfather, a legacy deeply rooted in an old-school work ethic and craftsmanship. In fact, when I say deeply rooted, I mean his story technically began on a Christmas tree farm.
And my mom grew up on a Christmas tree farm. I that's where I grew up too, because they moved back home. They built a house like literally walking distance to my grandparents, and they raised me on the farm. And so my dad actually, when I was little, he took some time off of work and stayed home and did some consulting, you know, so that he could spend a little bit of time with me when I was really little. And then when I was old enough to go to daycare, they both went back into full-time corporate hustle. And I got off the school bus at my grandparents' house, you know, most of my young life. And so my parents, I would say, were both like side hustle entrepreneurs, because we still had that Christmas tree farm that was started by my great-grandfather, because he actually worked for the state of Pennsylvania as a forester for 25 years without getting a raise.
Oh my goodness.
So finally just said, forget this. I'm starting my own thing. And he started a Christmas tree farm in 1941. Back then, Christmas trees were big business, you know, all local. You didn't have big box retailers selling trees. And most of the population had a real, alive Christmas tree. And then he passed that on to my grandfather, who ran the farm and also had a full-time job as a forester. And so the Christmas tree farm was kind of the side hustle for the family for I mean, 50 years.
Now, just out of curiosity, because I know my listeners probably don't. I don't. From a Christmas tree business, what is the volume that a single farm puts out? Like just like your family farm at the time, how many trees per season?
Yeah, so a good year in the heyday was probably between 500 and 700 trees for us.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's why it was a small business, a side hustle, because even if we sold them for $75, you know, do the math, that's not a whole lot of total revenue.
Yeah.
You know, you're really not feeding a family on that. The big business Christmas tree farms nowadays in like North Carolina and the Northwest, they probably do 100,000.
Wow.
So this was a very small business. But my great-grandfather and my grandfather, I have to give them props because they realized early on who their client was and who their target customer was. And that was the doctors and the lawyers and country clubs. Like we specialized in large trees that were too big for your middle income household. And so as you know, most Christmas tree farms where you can go and cut your own, you can just walk into the field and cut it. It's all this big experience. My grandfather was like, nope, we're not going to let anyone into our fields. We're not going to let anyone touch our trees. We're going to save the best ones and they're going to be for the country clubs.
That's awesome.
And so we never had a Christmas tree go to the White House, but we did have Christmas trees go to some really big country clubs, some really big in the Northeast, really famous places, mostly country clubs. And we had some pretty cool clients doing that kind of stuff. So
growing up is, I mean, you mentioned you never had one go to the White House. Was that, now reflecting back on that as we're talking, like, was that something you were always aware of? Like, there's a chance we could have a family Christmas tree in the White House. Was that something that was a talking point among the family, or you knew that was like, that was the badge of honor for Christmas tree farmers?
You know, it's just a badge. It's a badge of honor. It's just a badge of honor. That and like Rockefeller Center, the big tree there, we never got them that big. I mean, the biggest trees that we sold were in the 24 feet.
Oh, wow. That's
huge. But those go to hospitals for their main entryways and the country clubs and that kind of stuff. Those, that's still not even big enough for, definitely not for Rockefeller Center, but even for the White House. I'm not sure how big their trees are, but my grandfather and my great-grandfather were smart. And I think most of those trees are donated and they wanted to get paid for it. we never donated anything to anyone. Yeah. It was, you know, it's a hard business. So don't give it away for free. Why would you?
When did you know that maybe entrepreneurial journey was part of your story? Or did you, growing up, you're like, I do not want to be an entrepreneur? Like, what was in your mindset, let's say high school years?
Never had a dream to be an entrepreneur. I never really talked about it much. I was definitely raised around entrepreneurs and the entrepreneurial mindset just because we had the farm and that was our business. That was our family business. I remember, you know, learning how to sell Christmas trees at age 5 or 6 and how to talk to people. And when they started walking towards the door, like try to figure out how to get them to stay. And if they didn't see the third aisle of trees, you know, where we have the different kinds back there, like make sure you at least recommend they check that out before they go on to the next farm. You know, I got taught how to sell really early. And then my parents got divorced when I was 16, I think. And when that happened, I kind of dove in and helped a lot more with the business side of the farm. My grandparents are getting a little older. My grandmother was always the one that did the books. Mm-hmm. You know, she needed some help. And so I kind of had to help a lot more because my dad moved away, not very far away, but he became less involved in the business and my mom owned the farm and I just helped out. And so through late high school and all of college, I would come home during the holiday season as much as I could and help out. And I think that was one of the first tastes of like truly, you know, managing other people and giving my advice on what I would do if this happened and that happened. And also, you know, we're talking, this was, like 2009 is when I graduated from high school. And so that's about the time when the big box retailer started selling Christmas trees. And so business was starting to get a lot harder for us. And so just a lot of stuff kind of happened all at once. And I just, you know, I helped where I could, and it was always fun for me. It was never work. So that was kind of, I would guess my first taste of entrepreneurship and business, yeah. Small business management. But when I got to college, when I was a freshman, it was pretty early in my freshman year. So I went to Penn State because it's a great school, and I got in-state tuition, and it was 2.5 hours away, which is like just far enough that I don't have to go home for everything. But close enough that I could drive home. It was 2.5 hours. So I could drive home for, you know, a weekend if I wanted to. And I got recruited for this thing called College Works Painting. It's basically an opportunity for you to run your own small business as a college kid. And there's a lot of college painters types of businesses.
Okay.
But like Cutco style, we went door to door and knocked on people's doors in our hometown and asked if they wanted their house painted.
And for those that don't know what Cutco is, that's the door-to-door knife company, right? Yep.
Okay. Yep. And so I got recruited for College Works Painting. And funny enough, I had to go to 3 different recruiting sessions for them to take me, because I was an engineer. You know, looked at me like I was a nerd. You know, I thought I wanted to be an aerospace engineer, and they mostly hired business majors or communications majors. You know, people that would inherently be good at sales, because it was mostly sales. I had to knock on the door a whole bunch of times, and I was just like, you got to let me do this. I think I'd really be good at it. And I was number 1 in the state and number 3 in the nation, out of at least 1,000 people.
Wow. That's incredible.
And I ran a $129,000 business the summer of my freshman year as a 19-year-old. So
now, out of curiosity, because it's a school-run program, I'm assuming the $129,000 book of business, was that actually something you got to manage and therefore reap the profits from that, as far as once you eliminate the costs and everything? Or was this just you were sales and it was an internship?
Yeah. So they run it like an MLM. So the company, it's called College Works Painting. It's not actually associated with Penn State or any school in any way that I know of. They have managers, district managers and vice presidents that work at a school and recruit college kids to do what I did, which they call an intern or a branch manager.
Okay.
And basically I got recruited. I went through the training process. They taught me everything I needed to know about house painting, told me everything I needed to know about how to estimate how much it would cost to paint a house, how much paint it would take, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they let us loose and they said, go knock on doors, and any door that has some peeling paint on it, literally peel the paint off the door in front of the homeowner and tell them that, oh, now I need house painted. And I ended up just being really good at that and good at the sales side of that. I'd never held a paintbrush in my life, never painted a thing in my life. And they actually made fun of me because at the paint training, when they actually taught us how to paint a house so that then we could hire the painters to actually go do the work in the summertime. Yeah. My manager knew I'd never touched a paintbrush, and he handed me a paint can and said, hey, can you open this for us? And I'd never opened a paint can in my life. And I sat there and everyone's laughing at me, like trying to use a screwdriver to get into this paint can. Cause I'm an engineer. I'm not dumb. Like I can figure out how to open a paint can, but it took me a lot longer than it should have. And they're all laughing at me. And my manager stands up and says, all right, I want all of you to stop and take a look at this kid who is a couple years younger than most of you and is currently kicking all of your asses.
I love it.
Know how to open a paint can, and he's outselling every single one of you. So what's wrong?
That is awesome. I love that.
As a scapegoat, you know, to try to motivate the rest of his team. I didn't see it like that at the time. I was pregnant. I was embarrassed, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But looking back on it, and now that I'm friends with him, he taught me everything I know. His name's Joe. And he taught me everything I know about the hustle, you know, the art of the sale and managing my first real group of people. And that was a really good test of his sales management and sales leadership, is basically using me as an example to motivate everybody else. But yeah, anyway, so that was my first real tranche of entrepreneurship is called Fieldwork Painting. And, you know, not everyone does as well as I did. You know, out of the $129,000 in total revenue, I probably pocketed, I don't know, $25,000.
Yeah. Oh, so there was compensation for you. It wasn't just an internship or learning experience. I mean, there was compensation. That's great.
No, it was a business. Yeah. I mean, awesome. It was, you know, I probably could have managed that business better and made more profit, but I learned so much. It was invaluable. And I used that money to invest into things that have gotten me where I am today. So
going through that experience, was that throughout your entire college time or just your freshman, sophomore year? What was that?
Yeah. So that was freshman year. And then, I said, it's basically an MLM. So my second year, they recruited me to then recruit other people like me that would then run their own business in their hometowns respectively. And I ended up not being very good at that. I'm pretty good at managing people directly, but managing managers is where I started to fail. And so I also wasn't really good at recruiting people. I'm really good at selling things, but selling a job, selling an entrepreneurial opportunity to college kids was really difficult. And I wasn't good at it.
Yeah.
And so I ended up having a really small team and I did okay. I probably doubled the business year over year, my sophomore year. But I would say half the business was still me personally hustling, knocking on doors, selling stuff. Like, it wasn't my team. I was doing it myself. So the one thing I would say though is that's how I met my business partner for Vortec Watch Company. Is I recruited him to work for me my second year in College Works Painting. And his name's Tyler. He was my best manager. I don't know how much he made that year, but he was the best person on my team, which was very small. And so I spent a lot of time with him, helping him sell painting and helping him manage the job sites and hire the painters and all that stuff. And we became friends through that. And my junior year, he and I started playing golf in college. And we both got out of College Works at that point and moved on to other things. But that's where we had the idea for Vortec, is on the golf course.
On the golf course, junior year, you were saying? About junior scene?
My junior year, his sophomore year, sometime in the spring, we were out on the white course at Penn State playing a quick round. And we were just talking about watches and how he was always a watch guy and really liked watches and couldn't afford the ones that he wanted. I was studying industrial engineering and was fascinated by additive manufacturing. Mostly metal 3D printing is what I was really fascinated by. And so I was talking to him about metal 3D printing and like all the use cases for that. And we were talking about like, what if we could make a watch that's actually made in USA, like 100% made in America? Because most watches are Swiss or Japanese or Chinese in today's day and age.
So let's pause there for a second real quick, because I think there's a lot about the watch industry that plays into your story that I don't think most people know about the watch industry. So you mentioned right there, most of them are Swiss or Japanese made. In like 3 minutes, can you give a brief history of just watchmaking in the States, and how did that stop happening in the States?
Great question. So let's go way back. So the watch was invented hundreds and hundreds of years ago, but in the mid 1800s, until about the mid 1900s, America was the Switzerland of the world. The best watches in the world, especially in the late 1800s, early 1900s, were made in the United States. And back then, they were pocket watches. This is pre-wristwatch. The wristwatch was World War I, World War II, when that kind of started coming around. So late 1800s, we're talking about pocket watches. And we needed pocket watches in America because of the railroads. And we have a huge country, and we're talking, you know, massive westward expansion in the mid to late 1800s. And we were building railroads like crazy. And the railroads needed to have a time system. And everyone needed to know when the train was going to get there. Everyone on the train needed to know what time it was. And so everybody, you know, the conductors and the engineers, they all had pocket watches. And then that bled into the workforce and the everyday person in America wanting to carry a pocket watch so they could know what time it was. It's the equivalent of the cell phone today. Everyone had a And so America was making between 1850 and 1950, over 100 million pocket watches were manufactured in America.
Wow.
By at least 10 major companies. There was dozens of companies. On our website, we call them the 10 great American watch companies.
Okay.
They were the ones that made the most or are the most famous. And that those are the ones that we kind of focus on for what we do.
How did we start losing ground in that industry?
So, and this is my opinion from my own research.
Of course.
But World War I was, to most people's opinion, the invention of what we call the wristwatch today. I mean, there was wristwatches well before that, but mass market style, we call them the trench watch. And when you're in the trenches during World War I, you were always looking out over the battlefield, right? And you're holding your gun and you had to know what time it was without looking down. Because if you looked down, you could get shot.
Yep.
And so they literally strapped pocket watches to their wrist back then so that they wouldn't have to take their eyes off the battlefield. Mm. And so that was the trench watch. And so the military requested that these watch companies make them smaller timepieces that would be more comfortable on the wrist for trench watches. And so that's what gives you the history of the trench watch. And there's a lot of really cool books about that from World War I. And then everybody got back from the war and kept wearing their watch. And so people started wearing watches, and that became the cool thing to do. And then the same thing in World War II, but even more prevalent. And so that's kind of where the wristwatch came from. But then think about this for a second. Switzerland was neutral in World War I and World War II. So if you take all the time that World War I and World War II took up, the U.S. government said to all these watch companies, if you're going to make stuff, it has to be for the war effort. So you can only make watches that we can use in the war, or you need to use your metal and your machines to make firing pins or other small, you know, military application uses. So in World War I and World War II, all these U.S. manufacturers basically stopped research and development. They didn't have the ability. They were mandated that they had to just pump out watches for our soldiers. And Switzerland was neutral. So they're still doing R&D. They're still pumping out watches. They're inventing really cool stuff. I mean, they got at least a decade ahead of us because they didn't have to worry about it. And again, that's my opinion, but that's what seems to make sense to me, because after World War II, a lot of these U.S. companies started to fluster. They started their R&D didn't make as much sense as the Swiss R&D, and they started to go out of business one after the other. So,
well, I mean, when you're 10 years behind anything in an industry, it's going to be really hard to catch up, and you have to make a decision whether do we try to catch up, or do we just jump ship and try something new, or pivot into something totally different. So that completely makes sense to me. So thank you for that history lesson. So now back to your junior year, you're on the golf course, you're talking about your additive engineering, I think is what you called it, making things with metal, 3D printing, and the watch idea came up.
So basically, Tyler and I were talking about American-made wristwatches. This is like 2013. And we decided on the golf course that day that we were going to make a wristwatch. We were going to start a watch company and we were going to manufacture watches. And we started doing a whole bunch of research, and all the watches that we could find were Swiss, Japanese, or Chinese for that reason. And we wanted to make one that was actually made in the United States. And so we started doing all kinds of research. We couldn't find anyone that would make the movement or the internal timekeeping mechanism in the United States. You know, we could find a manufacturer that could make the case, you know, and the crown and the leather strap, you know, that stuff could be made, or we could find a belt company to make the leather, you know, mm-hmm. it's just a mm-hmm. smaller belt, right? All of that stuff was figure outable. It's just the inside, the actual gears and springs that tell time. All of that, the high quality stuff is made in Switzerland. And we were like, you know, why? You know, why can't we make it in America? And as we were searching that, as we were trying to figure that out, we stumbled upon the history of the old pocket watches that I just told you about. Mm-hmm. And I'm a history nerd, and I just dove in. I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. We made 100 million pocket watches back then. Where are they? How do we find them? And we found one in a pawn shop that had been scrapped. The gold case was scrapped, and the movement, the inside, was thrown away because the pawn shop just wanted the couple hundred dollars worth of gold. And first of all, you know, that was a shame. And second of all, the movement is it's a tiny little engine. It was made 100 years ago, but the stuff they made in the early 1900s was made to last forever. It wasn't it wasn't made like we make that stuff today. So, you know, we realized that, and we realized that there was a lot of them out there, and we realized that most of them are only worth the precious metal value of their case. And so we figured other people were probably scrapping them. And so we started looking around, and we found more and more and more. And we said, you know what? I think we have a business here. And so we launched what we call the American Artisan Series on Kickstarter, December of 2014, after, you know, over a year and a half of trying and testing and finding movements and working with, you know, hundreds of pawn shops and estate sales and flea markets to find these things. And that's where it started.
You said 2014 was the Kickstarter?
Yeah, December of 2014. So there was a lot to happen there. You know, I graduated from college in May of 2014. So a lot of life happened in that business.
How did that Kickstarter campaign do? Because, I mean, I think there's a statistic that it's like 82% of Kickstarter campaigns don't hit goal.
Yeah. Yeah. So we hit our goal in the first 12 hours.
That's
we set the goal kind of low, you know, so we were in our early 20s, fresh out of college. $10,000 was a lot of money. So we were like, you know what, if we can raise 10 grand, we'll go buy a 3D printer that'll be used for our prototyping purposes. And that'll give us enough to make a down payment on a few of these suppliers that we need to buy things from. So that's where we set. We set the goal at 10. We sold over 60 watches in 30 days and raised a little over $40,000 on our first Kickstarter campaign.
That's awesome.
And yeah, that's how we did it. And I would say a third of that was from friends and family and like friends of friends, like our immediate network. And then 2/3 of it was from random humans on the internet from all over the world, which is awesome. I mean, that's the power of Kickstarter, right? I mean, we
ship
boxes to Australia to people that we'd never met and just saw me and Tyler making a video in our garage about how we wanted to preserve American history one watch at a time.
That's awesome. Would you consider the launch of that Kickstarter campaign to be the beginning of Vortec Watches?
Correct. Yeah. That was really our first product launch.
So before we unpack Vortec Watches a bit, as you're going through all of the history of it and being a history person, and you're young, right? So let's talk about some of the things you had to work through in order to make that happen. I mean, you're talking about tackling or entering into a space that is just, it's just a monster. I mean, and it's a monster outside of the US that controls the market. You talk about Swiss and Japanese. And I think of it similar to Dollar Shave Club, right? I mean, when he started razors, you know, I mean, Gillette had 70% of the market, right?
You're gonna take on Procter & Gamble? Yeah.
Yeah, right. So what are you thinking? What are you and your partner, Tyler, thinking as you're, whether it be on the golf course or afterwards at the pub or whatever, like, what are you thinking when you're actually talking about entering watch making and bringing it to the States?
You know, it's funny. Tyler and I laugh about this all the time because we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. We didn't do any research on any of that. We had a really good idea. We were super passionate about the idea and we put it on the internet and people loved it. And so we were like, all right, cool. We have a business. we got so lucky. One anecdote is 100 years ago, there were those 10 great American watch companies, right? But there was only three companies that made the cases, the gold and silver cases. Okay. And at some point, probably late 1800s, there must have been a mastermind meeting of those 10 people that ran those 10 different watch companies. And they said, you know what, guys, let's make all of our cases standardized. All of them will be the same size. We'll have these 8 or 10 sizes. Mm-hmm. And that way we can share these suppliers that make the gold and silver cases. And that happened 100 years ago. We didn't know that happened. We had no idea that there was a standardization of pocket watch cases until, honestly, about a year in after the Kickstarter, when customers started sending us their grandfather's pocket watches and stuff. And we were like, wow, this is the same size as that one that we just saw last week. That's kind of cool. Started doing a bunch of research, started working with professional watchmakers that have been doing this for longer than we've been alive, who started telling us cool stuff like that. And we were like, wow, that's awesome. That probably makes what we're trying to do way easier. And once we learned that, then we really dove into that. We figured out the engineering behind those standardization of cases. And we were able to standardize our cases and our process for when we're putting those pocket watch internals into our modern cases. Now we have a standard set of engineering and just a standard few sizes because we got so lucky that that happened 100 years ago. Yeah. So, my dad always says, mostly about golf, I'd rather be lucky than good. and that is 100% true on that, you know, distinct fact. We had no idea. I mean, we would have figured it out, like, you know, 3D printing, we're engineers, like we had the resources to make every single watch completely one of a kind from an engineering standpoint. But the fact that they standardized, it's the only reason we can do it for the price and the cost that we do today.
That's awesome. So the Kickstarter closes, you've exceeded goal. Now it's you and Tyler are thinking, now we got to do something, right? So what are the early days of Ortic Watches?
Yeah, so at that time, we were in Colorado at that point. I had taken a job with Walmart in Colorado after graduation, because after the painting thing, I did an internship with Procter & Gamble in Pennsylvania. And then that got me in the door with Walmart because they're, you know, suppliers of each other, right?
Yep.
I did an internship down in Bentonville, Arkansas for Sam's Club, you know, the baby brother of Walmart. And then while I was there, they offered me a job in logistics for Walmart, Walmart Logistics Engineering. So I was one of 100 engineers that basically was in charge of helping to redesign the Walmart distribution centers so that they could keep up with Amazon at that point and fulfill orders to the stores and also to homes. And so that was my first job out of school, my corporate job, and what paid the bills for us for 2 years. I worked for them in Loveland, Colorado, here just a little south of us. They put me in Colorado because it was really cheap for me to fly everywhere else. I traveled about 75% of the time. And so I was kind of like internal consulting, basically. Yeah. And that was an awesome job. Because of that job, I was able to buy a house when I got here. And Tyler lived with me in that house. And we used the basement and the garage of that house to make watches for almost a year.
That is awesome. So that is, now we're in 2016.
Yep. Late 2014, we're on Kickstarter.
Yep.
We sell 60 watches or so at a huge reduced price. That was kind of like our offering on Kickstarter.
Of course.
It's like, hey, this will be half price, you know?
Yep.
And it took us until, I would say, May of 2015 to ship the first watch.
So 5 months. Got it. Okay.
5 or 6 months to figure out how to make the thing we sold.
Yeah.
Yeah. which was 3 times longer than we thought it would take. And that happens a lot on Kickstarter. And so all of our...
So going into Kickstarter, you had not done this yet.
No.
You just had an idea. And you're like, yeah, we can do this.
Yeah. I mean, we 3D printed some prototypes. We had some suppliers set up. We had a rough cost of goods sold estimate. And that was it. I would call it minimum viable product is what we took pictures of and put online. And And we told that story and we said, hey, we're just a couple of kids out of school with what we think is a cool idea. So anyway, May of 2015, we made the first watch, shipped the first watch. I think we probably shipped the last watch from Kickstarter late that year. So fast forward to 2016. In 2016, you know, we started really selling watches through our website. And we probably sold about 100 watches in 2016, okay. Just working out of a small office space at that point. And then 2017, we got a larger office that was also retail facing and had a little retail shop, which was one of the worst ideas we've ever had. But
retail is expensive.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I don't know how much the square foot cost was, but to today, we still have people walk into our current workshop, which is kind of off the beaten path, and they say, hey, you were at Jessup Farm, which is like this really cool little farm community down the street from where I live. People in Fort Collins, Colorado know that place to be really cool and like this quintessential part of the town.
Yeah.
And they associate Vortec Watch Company as being one of the first tenants there. So that's kind of cool. Not worth the tens of thousands we spend in rent, but kind of cool. Anyway, we realized pretty fast that we only had about 500 square feet for, you know, four people at that time. And people were just walking in, not going to buy anything, just walking in so they could see what we were doing. Half the people that walked in, they were like, oh, you guys make watches? How long you been in business? And what are you doing? You know, like just that kind of like, just
you're like, oh, that's cute.
Like, how long is this business going to last? You know, which is fair. Because we probably looked like we were a startup, because we were. So that lasted, I think we outgrew that space in about 10 months or so. Mid-2017, we moved to our current space, which is a 2,000 square foot warehouse about a mile and a half outside of town that we pay the same amount per month for that 2,000 square feet as we did for the 500 here locally. And then late 2017, we got our first CNC machine and started making a lot of our own parts. And that got us addicted to making our own parts. And so now we have two CNC machines and a lathe on the way now with another 5-axis machine after that. So now we're making a lot of our own components, which is really awesome.
Is that the inner workings of the piece? Is that what you're referring to?
We make all the outside. So probably, I think this might be a good time for me to literally show you what we do. So everything, this is cool. I would like 60 minute style. I don't know if you can hear that. But it's kind of everything on the inside of this watch is an old pocket watch.
Okay.
And so you all see it's back there. And it's a little glare, you know. But all those gears and springs, that is old. And then what we make is the case, so the outside ring around it, the glass on both the front and back to protect it. Mm-hmm. This crown is what we call it, the winder. So these are all that you have to manually wind them every day. There's no batteries. It doesn't move with your wrist like a modern watch. You literally have to wind it like the old pocket watch. We don't change the engineering of it. And then we also make the screws, you know, that hold this whole thing together. And then the leather strap and the metal buckle. So basically everything inside is old. Everything outside is new.
And all of them are beautiful. Like for those listening, if you have not been to Vortec Watches, VortecWatch.com?
VortecWatches.com. Yep.
VortecWatches.com. My favorite is the Railroad Edition. The watches are stunning. As a fan, that's why I reached out to RT. Just as a fan, I wanted to know more about his story and how this came to be and bringing watchmaking back to America. But, you know, as I'm listening, to your story, RT, I see the early days of just learning and selling and having successes as a young salesperson, having successes in that painting MLM, and then having your sophomore year realizing something that you weren't good at, and that's recruiting people, managing managers. And now you're growing an enterprise that is looking to take on the Swiss giants, if you will, of watchmaking. Is there at any point in time, do you doubt that you're able to pull this off?
every time you're about to sign a huge financial document, that thought crosses your mind for sure. So the most recent one was the most recent piece of equipment, you know, is over $100,000 for this most recent machine. And I personally guarantee it. And so if we don't make that payment on the machine, they'll come and take my house. And so,
and you're married with kids now, right now, right?
That is, yeah. And you know, I have a son who is 18 months old and another one on the way and a home and a family to take care of.
So why do that? Why do that? Why? So, you know, again, you know, we talked a little bit, some of the listeners are reluctant entrepreneurs. You know, there's a bit of fear and hesitance in it. What is it about Vortech Watches? What is it about the mission of bringing American watchmaking back to the States? What is that that is so significant to you that you're willing to do that?
I firmly believe that we make the coolest watches on planet Earth. And I am so excited about what we do that I can't even put that into words. Every single watch we make is one of a kind. It tells a story. It's a conversation piece. So you said we're taking on the Swiss giants, but I mean, you can't compare what we do to what they do in any way. Yeah, we make a wristwatch, but people say that to me all the time. They're like, well, what about the Apple Watch? Like, isn't that gonna, you know, put the entire watch industry out of business? And the answer is no. People buy our watches because they want to talk about them, because they want to support the company that made them, because they want to support American made, because every time somebody looks at one of our watches on your wrist, they're going to ask about it because it looks a little different and the crown's at 12 o'clock and you know, it's like, is that an old pocket watch? You know, and that starts a conversation which can lead into other things. And that's why people buy watches now. And that is so exciting. And for me, it's really exciting because I did some research and I called a lot of our customers. Most of our customers are small business owners. They're entrepreneurs. They work in management at a company. You know, they're just like me and they want to support me and I want to support them. That's why I do it, is because it's awesome. You know, I wake up every day and it's different. Like, I still don't know a lot about watches. I'll be really honest with you, just like I never knew much about painting. It's not about watches for me. It's about the experience that our product gives to the customer and the experience that running this business gives to me every day.
You know, it's interesting. You've said a few things there that I have been preaching for. I'm a few decades older than you are, and I've been preaching something you just mentioned right there. Entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs, period. For anyone who has brought something from nothing and laid a bit of themselves on the line to do it, they understand what it is that went into that and they're willing to support it. So the fact that you reached out to other small businesses because you want to support them, that is what I've been preaching for a few years. So awesome that you're doing that as well. The other thing that, you know, you talked about, you know, you don't know watches, or I forget what, I don't want to misstate that phrase, but what was the exact phrase you said?
I still don't know everything there is to know about watches.
But what's interesting when you think about, as your time with Walmart and Sam's Club and logistics and everything, what I pick up very quickly is that you have the ability to understand and connect the dots between idea and product and end consumer and all the logistics in between. You were great at sales. I could love the Christmas tree story. You're great at selling as Christmas. Granted, you were 5 or 6. So a 5 or 6-year-old can sell a whole lot of things to a whole lot of people because it's just so stinking cute when it happens.
Pretty cute back then.
You know, but you were, you know, you learned sales early on with the painting as well. So you were very quick for that. Does Tyler fill in the gaps on the operational side for you, or how does he complement what you do?
Yeah. So funny story about Tyler. I was an engineer in college and Tyler was a math major. And now he does all of our engineering and I do all of the talking to our customers. We totally switched our career paths. And at first it was because everything I did at Walmart was via email and phone. And so I was just really good at answering emails and getting back to people quickly. And I didn't mind talking to people on the phone.
Yeah.
And Tyler was much more proficient at figuring out how to make things and diving into the research side of finding a supplier and finding the right supplier and testing things and all that kind of stuff. Like, he was fascinated by all that. His dad was a mechanic, is a mechanic. And Tyler helped in the shop with his dad, and that was, you know, their family business. And so he just really liked figuring out how things worked. That's kind of like, we just started dividing up the work like that. Plus, I could answer people's emails after I was done at Walmart, and if we needed to contact suppliers, that really had to be done during the day. And so it was just a clear separation of like what was going to happen, because when I was full-time at Walmart, Tyler was full-time on Vortic. He worked on Vortic full-time since we started on Kickstarter.
Okay. Are you full-time with Vortic now?
Yes. After 2 years with Walmart, I left. It was May of 2016. So it's been another 2 years, 2.5 years now that I've been full-time for Vortic. But yeah, so anyway, it's funny that Tyler just kind of took over what on paper probably should have been what I was doing. And we totally switched. And now it's awesome because he has owned that completely. And he's taught himself how to use all of our CNC machines, literally via YouTube.
YouTube University, I'm telling you.
Yeah, I mean, he today manages and writes programs for and operates over $250,000 worth of equipment from 100% YouTube and a couple of conversations with our advisors that run other companies. So yes, to answer your question, he does all of the manufacturing. And then we together had the realization about, I guess about 2 years ago, that if I was going to be focused on sales and marketing and PR and that constant hustle of trying to get people to know that we exist,
yeah,
I couldn't also be the one that manages the people putting together the watches. I couldn't also be in charge of saying, okay, this customer's watch gets made today and this customer's watch gets made tomorrow. The whole production and operational side of the business, we needed another person. And so we put out the call, which funny enough, he just walked into our shop one day. His name's Thane. We hired him about 18 months ago. And we literally hired him to, for all intents and purposes, be a business partner and take over the other third of the business that really needed help. And the thing I said about me not being good at managing managers, it's been the hardest thing for me to work with Thane, because I want to micromanage. Like, I want to say, like, hey, I talked to the customer, I sold this watch to this customer, we got to get it done, we got to prioritize it in front of this other thing or whatever. And Thane's just like a rock. He's just like, nope, this is how it's going to happen. This is more efficient. It doesn't matter what you told the customer, this is how it's going to happen, because that's better for our business. And I love him for that. And we've butted heads a lot. It's been hard as hell for all of us to like figure out how to work together. But I think now, after, you know, over a year, we're really hitting our stride and things are picking up for us, and it's going really well. So
let me do a little math there. So you said you left Walmart about 2 years ago. Your son is 18 months, which would mean your girlfriend was pregnant at the time. How did that conversation go? And in what, where was the business at? You thought, you know what, this is a great time to leave a stable job and go full-time and carry the burden with Vortic.
So Vortic, at the time that I left Walmart, we were launching our second product. And it was something that was really exciting for me. And I thought it was going to take over the world. We were going to sell thousands of them. It was going to be absolutely bonkers, right? And I've been planning the product launch for months and months. And I was like, okay, I'm going to leave the job. I'm going to take a 10-day vacation. After that 10-day vacation, I'm going to launch this product on Kickstarter. And that product is going to triple our business, and then we'll figure out how to pay me from the proceeds of that new product. I quit the job, I take the vacation, spend a lot of the money that I had in the bank on that vacation. Mm-hmm. But I needed a break. And we launched the product. we hit our goal in the first 10 hours. You know, it was great. Our goal was, 50, 60,000. We hit it. We raised like 75,000 in like 2 or 3 days. And then we got a call from one of our suppliers who basically said, hey, this other supplier that we're looking at using to help work on this project for you, you don't want to work with them. This is not a good idea. None of this is a good idea. And we had to pull the plug on Kickstarter. That was our Kickstarter number two. We pulled the plug. We gave everybody their money back. We walked away. I was doing a tour of America that I had set up to go to all these different jewelry stores and like sell them on the product and talk to them. And we were doing the pop-ups, our friends' bars and stuff, trying to sell watches. And we were hustling and it was working. But the product that we wanted to make wasn't possible. And it was honestly the largest failure that we've had as a business. And I think about it all the time, and we still haven't launched that product because we're really close. We've almost figured it out now, and we have to make almost everything ourselves to do it right. And so it's just going to cost a lot more money, take a lot more time. So it'd be awesome. But we pulled the plug on it. And so since we pulled the plug on that, we pivoted and we spent all the time and money and energy and R&D that we had set aside for this new product on making our original product better. And we call that version 2, which is what I just showed you on my wrist. Mm-hmm. It's what you'll see on our website. We basically gutted the entire product that we make and made everything about it better. And then we started selling that. And so we flopped and floundered for 3 or 4 months trying to figure that out. And that was a really depressing time for me.
What was going through your mind during that time? And let's talk about that time, because I think there's encouragement and learnings for those listening. You had left because you were optimistic and you were planning on that Kickstarter being outstanding and the product to be great and to kind of carry you into that transition. And it just didn't play out like that. Obviously, the Kickstarter did perform, but you had to pull it because the product provider. So what was going on in your head during those months?
I mean, it was like a really bad time of my life, but I took the energy and I put it into the revisions to our current product. I put it into the fact that we needed to make a lot of significant changes in the business. That's when we started talking about hiring Thane, who's our, I call him COO, production mm-hmm. manager now, because I was trying to do way too many things at once. And so was Tyler, and kind of realized that, and we realized we needed help. And so we started looking for help. And so we found more people to help us physically in the business and also investors. You know, we went out and raised another round of investment and renegotiated our small business loan and got a larger small business loan and basically said, okay, this thing that we wanted to do didn't work. Here's what we're going to do with that time and money and energy anyway. It's going to be awesome. It's going to improve this, this, and this. And we use that platform to make all those changes. And so it was, for me, scary and depressing that we failed launching that product. But again, a huge learning experience. And my dad is one of our advisors and has helped me through a lot of that stuff. And he was a proponent of me leaving the corporate job. You know, I mean, he questioned all my family and friends, you know, everybody questioned that idea first, but my dad said, they're going to hire you back. If this doesn't work, like, they were just trying to promote you and make you move to Bentonville to the home office. Like, they're going to hire you back in a heartbeat. Like, you were killing it at that job and working a side hustle at the same time. If the side hustle doesn't work out and you come crying back, you know, you might have to take the same salary and you'll be a year behind your peers, but that's life. At least you tried. And my girlfriend said the same thing. And Lindsay, she was, you know, really supportive. And 3-4 months after we got back from that failure and we, started rebuilding and started, working on this new product, Lindsay and I found out we were pregnant, which it wasn't a good time. We didn't plan for it. I was looking at buying rings. I didn't have any money. So I was trying to figure out how to like finance a ring, even though I spent every cent I had.
Or 3D print a ring.
Yeah, just something like that. I was trying to figure out, like, okay, we sell a couple watches through this one jewelry store. Maybe I can, like, trade some watches for I was going down that path. And then we found out we were pregnant and she's like, hey, save your money. Let's make sure our son has a good life. And we'll get married later, you know? So she was immensely supportive and she's an entrepreneur too. So she gets it. And again, knock on wood, a lot of luck in there. Cause she makes way more money than I do. And so I found a good one and, hanging on to that one for sure. and she is willing and able to let me keep working without getting paid much. That, among a lot of other things, has been our saving grace.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Where do you see Vortec Watches in 3 years?
I don't know. So three years from now feels like a really long time. I guess we've been around for five, which feels like forever. But 2019 is going to be a growth year. We're going to try to double the business. We're going to try to make 800 or 900 watches in 2019.
That's awesome.
And we've always sold more watches than we can make. So I imagine we'll probably sell 1,000.
What goes through your mind when you say that out loud? Probably sell 1,000 watches.
It's funny because my initial business plan for the company was to sell 1,000 watches in year one. So I keep shooting for the stars and I keep ending up like a little bit down the road, and I shouldn't complain because it's fun and the journey's awesome. And, you know, we're cash flowing now and everybody's happy. And I think I can pay myself this year. So like there's a lot of really good stuff happening, but, I still want to do more. Like I want to make more products. I want to have more customers. We're releasing two new products this year, including the one that we failed to launch on Kickstarter the first time. So I'm going to be really excited to actually see that in person. We call it the Journeyman series. And it's basically our first fully modern watch. Uses a Swiss made movement on the inside, and all the other components are made in America. And so that'll be our first like fully modern watch. Should be really exciting in a different size and stuff like that. So you know, this year we're just trying to double the business, just trying to like really build a good foundation. 3 years from now though, we really want to be known for online customization. So right now you can scroll through about 100 pocket watches that we have in inventory and design, you know, the different color of case, different color of crown, different color of leather, and we make it to order. So 3 years from now, we envision you to be able to do that with a fully modern watch that would be a more production product that we can make thousands of instead of just dozens of, like our current products. We'll still be making the products we make now, but we'll just have other products and other product lines to offer across probably different price points. I think to more succinctly answer your question, 3 years from now, we're not going to be a small business anymore. We'll be a company. And that's really exciting.
That is awesome. When you look back on your journey up to this point today, you know, I'm a big believer that if we lose sight of those who are so pivotal to our success, it'll ultimately lead to our failure. Who do you point to with just an immense amount of gratitude towards because of how supportive they have been for you in your journey?
For the whole journey, it's been my dad, you know, my life's journey. I wrote a Father's Day blog post on Vortec's website.
And we'll include a link to that in the show notes because I read it as well. It was awesome.
I guess it was six months ago now, you know, Father's Day. And my dad called me just crying, you know, as after he read that. But that was true. Everything I said was from the heart, and I wrote it because I'm a dad now, and I talk about it a lot with my friends that are dads. And it's like, you know, the whole nature versus nurture thing. Like, how do I raise an entrepreneur? Like, not that I want my son or my sons now to like, I want to force them to be entrepreneurs, but like. Yeah. How do I raise them in a way where they believe that they can do whatever they put their mind to? And I think it's really simple, and it's what my dad did. And it's every time you read a bedtime story and it's about a fire truck or a astronaut or something, if they're excited about it, tell them, hey, if you want to be a fireman someday, that's absolutely what you should do. You know, you can do anything you put your mind to. And my dad said that so many times. I can remember it, even though it's one of the only things I remember at my age from when I was little. And he and my mom and my family, they all said that to me in one way or another throughout all of my life. My mom and my grandma were the most scared for me when I left my corporate job to be an entrepreneur, even though they were scared. And they asked me a lot of times, they said, you know, are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure you want to do this? When I kept saying, yes, I'm sure. Yes, I'm sure this is what I'm going to do. They stopped asking and they said, okay, if that's what you're going to do, then how can we help? That's awesome. Like how, like I think about that all the time now as a dad, like how do you do? Cause you know, your kids are going to do stuff that are going to piss you off.
You know?
Do stuff that you don't want them to do. How do you stay positive? How do you not crush their accidentally? Right. So definitely my dad. And then most recently, my girlfriend, Lindsay, for literally financially supporting me and emotionally supporting me on the good and the bad days. You know, when I got back from that second Kickstarter that failed, she could have said, well, maybe you should do something else. And she said, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, I think, you know, Tyler and I talked about it and I think we can do this, this, and this. She's like, cool. Go to bed, wake up tomorrow and do it. You know,
that's so awesome. Did that, I mean, it's because in my own journey, there's moments that my wife has said something similar in some of the darkest of times. Did that inflate your chest, make you stand taller in the midst of that dark moment? That encouragement that she gave you?
For sure. I mean, it's, you know, someone that close to you, especially like as an entrepreneur, like I work so much. I love what I do. So I work a lot and I don't have a lot of time to spend with other people. So I don't have a whole lot of what I would consider close friends. And so her opinion matters so much to me because she's not just my partner. She's also my best friend.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, like what you said about your wife, like everything they say, everything they don't say and they infer, like it hurts, like it's, there's a lot of stuff that significantly impacts you that you don't even think about. It's the same thing as the parental conversation that we just had, you know? So yeah, so those would be definitely the two most influential people in my life that I can't thank enough. For sure.
But you hear people talk about how the entrepreneurial journey is a lonely journey and it shouldn't be. You know, we need people. You know, you mentioned an advisory board, right? Whether it be an advisory team or business partner or a life partner, spouse, girlfriend, whatever that is a sounding board for you, is someone that can hold you up when you just want to crumble sometimes. It definitely should not be a lonely journey. And I would say the successful companies, it's that it never was a lonely journey. They were with people and guidance the whole time. And so that's awesome that you have Lindsay that can do that for you. So yeah, those moments get heavy.
Yep. And a lot of big decisions happen in those moments. And a lot of big decisions are made under duress. And a lot of things could have gone differently had I not had a support system at all, for sure.
So for our listeners, whether it be the entrepreneur that is just frustrated with the levels of significant traction that they're getting isn't what they thought it was, or the reluctant entrepreneur that isn't quite sure if they're ready to make the leap into full-time entrepreneurship, or they think they can pull it off, or the defeated entrepreneur that just has had failure after failure after failure. With your journey, what do you say to those three? Any one of them or all of them?
Yeah, so Tyler and I laugh about this all the time. We feel like our motto at Vortic, what we should put on the wall, is we'll figure it out. Because we say that phrase way too often. but it's true. We say it all the time. Like, we will figure it out. And sometimes we'll figure it out means we messed up and we canceled the Kickstarter campaign and we do something totally different. Sometimes it means giving customers their money back because we just couldn't do what we said we were going to do. Sometimes it means taking six months to make something that we thought would take 6 days. But we'll figure it out. Like, there's always a way around that. There's always, you know, we just have to call every customer and say, I'm sorry. And stuff like that has happened a lot to us. And the one thing that that Thane has taught me when we hired him, and that he's said over and over to me recently, and that has just recently started to hit home, is you can't be scared of your customer, because that's the thing that keeps me up at night. I am deathly afraid of our customers. I'm afraid of our customers being mad at us for something, whether it's like it takes too long to make their watch gets damaged in the mail and we have to, you know, fix that or figure something out. It's we put the wrong leather strap on it, you know, stupid things that I stress about at this point. And 95% of our customers are going to forgive us for all of that stuff, especially if you just own it and you call them and you say, hey, we messed up. Here's what we're going to do to make it right. Not going to happen again. Those conversations recently that I've had with customers, that's when I've started to realize that a lot of my customers are just like me. They're entrepreneurs, they're small business owners, they're managers. Because I've had some of those conversations with the Railroad Edition that you said you liked.
I love that, that one.
That product, we launched it almost 2 years ago because we thought it would be, we thought we'd figure it out. And we did it, and it took us forever to make it, and we're still making it. We're only about halfway through the pre-orders that we've taken, and I've had to have a lot of really hard conversations with customers saying, hey, you remember that watch that you paid us $5,000 for 6 months ago? Well, we haven't actually started it yet. But here's the good news. 95% of those customers, they're like, first of all, I appreciate the fact that you personally called me, the owner of the company. That's really cool. Second of all, I'm a business owner too. I've messed up before, and everything you just said is really hard to say. So I appreciate that. And third of all, I'm seeing reviews online of the of my friends that just bought this watch and they got it, you know, just because they were a little bit ahead of me in line. And they're all super stoked because it's the coolest thing they've ever seen in their lives. So I'm going to wait for it. You know, there's always one guy that cusses you out and hangs up the phone and asks for his money back via this long email copying his attorney. That's only happened to me once. And I just clicked refund and it's gone, right? But most of the customers are like, it happens. We'll figure it out. So anyway, you need something like that. You need a phrase like, we'll figure it out, or, you know, we'll find a way. Or my first boss at College Works Painting, Joe, he always said, winners make it happen was his term, his we'll figure it out.
I love that.
What, you know, because he was all about sales, right? So he was like, if you want to win, you're going to hustle, you're going to get it done, you're going to make it happen. Winners make it happen. I think about that a lot too. So everyone's motivated differently. But I think the reason that we'll figure it out works for us, for me and Tyler, is we're engineers. We think like engineers. Engineers are creative problem solving. And so the we'll figure it out, that's a problem in front of us that we can see and we can figure out how to solve. It's another Rubik's Cube for us to tackle.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps us going.
What I love most about RT's story is all the key decision points in his journey and how in those moments he never took the safe route out of the fear of the what if or the unknown. He left a safe and stable job with Walmart because he had a plan of attack to help Vortig Watches carry the financial burden of his salary. Did it work out for him like he thought it would? No. His planned Kickstarter had to cancel due to supplier issues, and the money he was planning on was no longer in the game plan. Yet it worked out better than he had imagined. You might be thinking, James, I don't remember it working out better for him. All RT did was improve their existing product and sell more units. True, but in his darkest moment, when fear set in because of the failure of his Kickstarter, he thought there was no way out, and in the moment he was able to lean on the people closest to him to build him back up. See, the entrepreneurial journey is painted as one where we are warriors 100% of the time without fail. That is just not true because we're still humans. What makes us unique as entrepreneurs is the high levels of risk we are willing to take to bring our dreams to reality. What we need to realize, though, is that we are not able to do so alone. It is critical to lean on those around us to support us and believe in us in the moments when we are sucker punched by failure. That failure will make us better entrepreneurs, but the support of those around us simply make us better, period. In addition to having a core group of people around us, we need to seize opportunities to support the entrepreneurs we come across. With that in mind, show some support for RT and the Vortic Watch Company. Obviously, if you can afford it, buy one of their watches from vorticwatches.com, V-O-R-T-I-C watches.com. However, if that's not in your budget, then do something equally powerful and follow them on Instagram at Vortic Watches. Don't just follow them. Tag a handful of friends in a few of their photos. If you're an entrepreneur, you know how hard it is to get the word out about your business or product. Let's show RT and Vortic Watches some support today. But here's my personal ask for support from one founder to another. The startup story itself is a startup, and we would love to hear your story and possibly share your startup story. Please connect with us on Facebook or Instagram at thestartupstory.co. Mention us, comment on a post, DM us, or visit our website at thestartupstory.co to connect with us. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave a review. They really do help with being discovered by others. What also helps is that you share the startup story with a friend. The startup story is for entrepreneurs, so please do not underestimate the power of sharing the startup story on your LinkedIn profile so other entrepreneurs can discover us. Think about that. How many podcasts have you seen shared on LinkedIn? That's a great way to spread the word for us. So please share the startup story on your LinkedIn. In fact, most people struggle to share good content on LinkedIn anyways. So if you want to support the startup story, search for the Startup Story company page, follow us, and share our posts to help encourage other founders and spread the word about the podcast. Every single founder has a story, and the startup stories we bring to you every week can encourage and inspire another founder. It might just be what they needed to hear to keep moving forward on their dreams. I look forward to sharing these stories every Tuesday with hopes to inspire you to start your story.